saying good night.
We hate to go and miss this pretty sight.
So long, farewell, our feet is in adieu.
Adieu, adieu, to you and you and you.
So long, farewell, our feet is in goodbye.
We flit, we float, we flinky, flinky, fly.
So long, farewell, our feet is in goodbye.
The sun has gone to bed and so must die.
Goodbye.
Hi, this is WHFR Dearborn. It is about 3 o'clock, and I hear things in the background there. My name is Jay Koronick, and it's time now for the new WHFR Journal. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. And we're going to get there in just a minute, because we always start with our theme song. And we talk about getting down to the bones of the stories. You know, we read between the lines and all that. That's all very, very important. And we can't do it without the theme song at the beginning. So here it comes. Are you ready? Okay. The new WHFR Journal for Friday, March the 4th. We'll start now. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area. You know, WHFR is your friendly, local, non-commercial, independent public radio station. That's right. We don't get any money from federal government or state government. Just a little bit of money from the students who are on campus here as part of their student activity fees. And most of it comes from you folks listening. That's right. Listener supported, as they say on the big public stations, but much more true here than anywhere else. Our Radiothon Pledge Drive, our annual time to ask for money, will be coming up April 10th through 17th. Let me introduce my co-host today, Dennis Reimars. Hi, Dennis. What's up today?
How are you? Okay. I think this is going to be one of those shows, just judging from the way it began, and I mean that as a complimentary way it began. I have a feeling that we're together, Jay. You and I will learn a lot.
Yeah, thanks.
Dennis.
You're
okay.
Very welcome.
What actually happened, folks, behind the scenes at WHFR, one of our great volunteer alumni, who was a DJ on the station for, I think, more than a dozen years.
Yep.
It came by at 1 minute to three.
Of course. And no, 1 minute to one.
1 minute to one. Mm-hmm. Three. Mm-hmm. Well, it'll be 3 o'clock eventually. Yeah. Maybe he'll still be around. And he has, here's a plug for something on campus. He has his daughter mm-hmm. enrolled in the HFCC daycare facility, preschool facility on campus, one of the best in the area, run mm-hmm. in collaboration with the Dearborn Public Schools. And I thought that was great that, he made that choice. It's of course, a local facility, but it's also very well run. They even have a Montessori preschool component. I don't know if they have separate rooms for the two preschools, but Montessori is really good. My daughter went through that for preschool and even, I think it was first grade, too. So really in favor of that philosophy. I'm glad they didn't cut that from the budget this year in the Dearborn Public Schools, but we really don't know about what's going to happen with that. In the stories today that we have in front of us from the Press and Guide and the Dearborn Times Herald, which, of course, you can read for yourself, but you don't get our opinions and comments tossed in there. And we want to emphasize certain things and give you a little background on some of these things, too, all very important if you want to start thinking for yourself. The Dearborn Press and Guide from last Sunday, in this difficult economic time, did, of course, have a lead story about the State of the City address, which we presented to you in its entirety last week here on the new WHFR Journal. We recorded for you, and we made it the first half hour approximately. And you can, of course, listen to that yourself again by going to WHFR.fm, click on the Journal button, and choose last week, February 25th show, if you want to listen to that for yourself. But a supplement to that and the meaning of it, which, again, I also commented on last week, is that Dearborn Mayor O'Reilly is taking a 10% voluntary pay cut himself, and City Council is also slated for a 5.2% pay cut. Now, that's what was recommended by their Citizens Commission, and that's very, very significant, of course, their Citizens Commission there, and they're following those guidelines. So they're taking a little bit of that shared sacrifice. I was just thinking off the cuff about how our governor is going to work for only a dollar this year,
right,
Governor Snyder, and that's, of course, because he's very rich. But it sets a bad precedent for a poor person,
right,
if they would ever get elected for governor, because if they were expected to work for a dollar, they couldn't live. they wouldn't have any money to live on. And I think going to a larger issue, and you all know what I'm talking about, that public officials should be paid what they're worth. If anybody should be paid, our public officials should have a secure payment. Now, it's nice in Snyder's case that he's going to waive the money. It's a nice token because he doesn't need it. But, for example, Virge Bonaro, mm-hmm. if he would have won for governor, he needs it. Okay, his wife's a teacher, but, of course, if he cuts her pay,
right,
which he probably wouldn't do, he's got to have something to live on, folks, if he's not mayor of Lansing. He's a definitely a middle-class kind of guy.
Right.
He doesn't have millions of dollars in savings or investments and no other place to turn, so he shouldn't set a bad example at all. Public employees should work for nothing or desperation poverty level wages, because then no one would ever even consider it. Just it does incense me because somebody, oh, but all the benefits you get, health insurance. Well, I think everybody should get that. Excuse me. And if we all got it equally from the federal government, it would lower cost and maybe even increase quality, because we're only seventh in the world in terms of the quality of our system. And that's pathetic, you know, and we have the most expensive per person system in the world for healthcare. But, you know, if teachers, maybe some public employees would take lower paying jobs because what they're doing is for the good of all of us, you know, including the teachers, teaching our children the future of us, okay? Right. And maybe the security of having health insurance, a dental plan, and eye care, maybe that was one of the reasons that said, okay, I'll take less money, you know, and don't tell me that they're getting average salaries that are too high. Go take a look at what corporate executives are getting. You know, the top 2% control 80% of the money in this society, and they aren't paying their fair share. It's obvious. It just, look at the numbers. You know, after Social Security deductions come out up to $90,000 of income, and then if you make more than that, you don't pay anything more. You don't make any more contributions to social programs, not Social Security, not even Social Security. And of course, we know the wealthy have got plenty of their loopholes, so that many large corporations pay nothing in taxes. And you just can't tell me it's going to trickle down. There's no evidence that that works and has ever worked. Even George Bush the First denied voodoo economics many years ago, about a dozen years ago, when he was running against Ronald Reagan.
So you said that you used the word incensed. Is that you're incensed by the fact that that Schneider did that?
No, that in Wisconsin and around the country, and Fox News is attacking teachers as being paid too much.
Okay, good. Yeah, because I think Schneider did it because he can, and he doesn't expect any other governor to. And I think this is his way of already posturing for the next election. And come on, right? I mean, he's already looking at different ways.
Right. I'm just saying, it sets in people's minds, well, all of our governors don't have to get paid.
Well, that I totally agree with. Right, right. I mean, Schwarzenegger probably did the same thing, right? And Reagan probably did in California. So, I mean, there's
well, they could have. I don't think Reagan did, but.
No, he forgot. Yeah. But the teachers, though, you're exactly right. I mean, it's always been called the thankless position, and I think that people get skewed by the numbers. Schoolmaster, when he was here, Mr. Schoolmaster said that it's about $100,000 a year job, but that's not the income.
No, I think the average, including the benefits, as I tried to point out, the income is lower than that, and even with the benefits, on average. Now, maybe he was considering extra contractual. Some of the teachers, in order to, you know, they say, oh, it's only a 9-month job. Yeah, but the bills come in 12 months.
Right.
So some of the teachers will work extra classes in the summer with the school system or nights and putting in 70, 80, 90 hours a week. And they are being paid more for that extra contract. But the basic salary and benefits, it probably comes to 70,000-80,000.
Right, that's probably more realistic.
And I know you say, well, it's only $20,000, but what are all the Fox News commentators making for salaries? You know, they're not talking about, you know, giving a portion of their salaries to help the teachers of America. You know, is Fox News the future of our children? Do they think that they are so essential and so valuable that they're teaching our children better than the teachers who see them 10 hours a day, 5 days a week? This is not an easy job. And I even hear people, commenters, crazy people in the media, the national media, radio and TV, and I don't want to forget Glenn Beck, saying that teachers have it so easy. That they just, you know, they go in and they leave at 2 or 3. Yeah, but my daughter gets there at 6:30 in the morning, right. Okay, and she comes home with work all the time.
And Detroit teachers have 60 kids in their classroom soon, and your daughter's not far behind.
No,
Jay?
Seriously. She has close to 40 in hers.
And, so soon, you know.
And most of them are special needs students because they don't have money for full-time special needs.
Like,
and she
factor.
Has no background or training to help them, and these are seriously challenged students.
Some of them emotionally, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, right. Emotionally, physically, and, you know, it is, it's almost impossible for her to keep going. I mean, she, now that she's living with me, she tells me the stories about each one of her days, and it is, you know, the next worst thing to hell, I think. But she keeps going. She has plans. She's always looking for something that might work to get their attention, to get them to learn to read.
So she got in this not for the money. There were never any illusions. She knew, based on your background, what she's getting into.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of person that should be a teacher. I think you'll agree.
Yeah,
that kind of passion.
Yeah,
you know?
She chose the so-called lower levels, and I chose college right. at the outset. But, yeah, it used to be a much more fun occupation, and now it's just tons of hard work with right. almost no daily satisfaction coming from doing the job. It's a horror.
Oh, she's probably a wreck at the end
of
the
day. Not just her, but I mean many
right, right.
most teachers in other places, and then they're going to cut their pay.
And that's not even the worst school. That's what I'm saying.
Take away benefits.
Wow, this is So I come from a family of educators, as you know. Uh-huh. So I totally appreciate it. And his father, it's funny because my father, he did he taught classes on his breaks, to study breaks during the regular school year, taught summer school, and took on coaching positions in the sports department because he needed to make extra money. And I understand that, you know, you work hard.
Well, I do have a sort of a scoop here, and he did mention it to me, and he didn't say it was off the record, but it was just tentative. I saw Jim Schoolmaster last Wednesday night here on campus, and with his family, taking advantage of the 5101 restaurant, dining in the evenings, open to anybody in the public. Get a reservation first, though, folks. And he actually said he has a reserved table now. I said, "Did they put your name engraved on it?
Did they?
Because he comes almost every Wednesday. Of course, he's president of the school board, so he's got to get around the community and be seen.
He didn't carve his name with his keys, did he?
I don't think so. I just suggested that he might want to consider it, but or have someone do
it
for him.
The New Orleans buffet, if I'm not mistaken. So he came on a pretty good day.
Was that the week before? But anyway, he's been here almost. And he said when he was here with us, I said, what about that contract that there was a tentative agreement, even, you know, with pay cuts for the teachers and benefit cuts? But it was, you know, it wasn't huge, but it was like 3% almost in pay cuts and benefit cuts and so on. That's what the arbitrator, the state Michigan arbitrator, recommended. It's less than what the teachers wanted, of course, because it's cutting into them. And but it will save the school district a little money. And I made a case that I hoped it could happen. And he said, well, everything's off the table now because, you know, how can it happen when we're losing $6 million in terms of state revenue in addition to other things? But he said Wednesday, there's probably going to be that contract. They're probably going to sign it.
That's good.
And why? Because it gives the union the legal legitimacy.
That's it.
To champion causes, and the contract is a legal way to resolve disputes. I mean, it's an actual formal way. It's you know, the school district has to do such things, which they've agreed to as fair. The union has to do things in a certain order, like filing documents or giving information or whatever. Gives a framework for future negotiations. And it doesn't guarantee anything. In fact, it takes away things from the teachers, this particular contract. But he thought that they would go ahead and sign it anyway. And I think that's a wonderful thing because to lose bargaining rights and protections, let's not forget the protections.
Right.
I've seen teacher after teacher, and of course, you might say, well, in business where you don't have a contract, they can just fire you, you have no protection. Yeah, if you're not a publicly funded company, you can get fired at any time for any reason, just because they don't.
Or in a union.
Yeah, but if you have a union.
Right.
You know, then you have a legal representation and a process by which they can still fire you, but they have to give reasons, actual reasons why you're not a good employee.
So,
and that should be required in every situation, folks. A few of you out there now, actually our labor force is only 10% represented by unions in this country.
Really?
Whether it's public or private.
Interesting.
So unions have declined in membership for years and years. So to jump on the unions as if they're costing our country a lot of money is absolutely wrong. Also, I'd recommend, can you read your history books about the history of unionism and why we need it? Because we do. Now, sure, there's excesses in some unions, bad unions. But as Jon Stewart said last night on The Daily Show on Comedy Central, you can find examples of bad chief executives of certain corporations, Enron, or big investment bankers, insurance funds, AIG, and you can find corrupt people at all levels, Mr. Madoff, and you can You know, so pick your poison.
You're going to have that good, tick fix thing.
Good people. Yeah, I keep sort of coughing up this blue phlegm that includes the names of corporate corrupt. But so seriously, folks, this is a minor problem. The big focus should be on getting rights for all workers, public and private. And unionism is the only thing that, you know, workers have, unless the government wants to be the union of choice for all of the public workers. And apparently they're not, you know, they can't possibly set up enough people to organize and defend everybody. So anyway, so I thought it was good that Jim Schoolmaster, since it is a contract that saves them money anyway, that they are considering, have not done yet, right, voting in favor of putting that contract in place.
But to you, but in your opinion, and it sounds like Schoolmaster may have echoed this, is that it may not be ideal, but at least, I mean, it's a point of reference, if nothing else, to move forward, right?
Yeah.
Something to build on. So, yeah, nothing's ideal, though. We figure that out quickly, don't we?
There's such a thing as worker morale, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's, thank you. You bring in things that's not all black and white in numbers. Yeah. Sometimes it is things like that. And it's like, look, I'm emotionally better because I'm stable. I have security.
If you lose trust in your bosses, you're going to do a lousy job.
Absolutely. And, you're going to be looking for another
job. It's
natural.
It's just, it's subconscious, but it's natural.
You're right. You're right.
Okay. Well, moving on. Times Herald, I thought this was interesting, and maybe we should look a little more in detail about it. I hadn't seen it before. Listen to this title. It's in the Times Herald, which you may have a copy of, Dennis, but for this week. On page 3A, unbelievable. The headlines alone says it all, but it's unbelievable. Activists hope to keep radioactive waste out of local drinking water.
Oh, God, I'm relieved.
No, first of all,
only the activists?
Why are activists have to do this? Right. Where's our government? Where's the EPA? And in the same issue, unbelievable, in the same issue, one of the editorial opinions, the usual one from the Mackinac Center, which is the conservative think tank that only thinks conservative no matter what the issue is, and I'm sorry, that's true. They got their reasons, but so did Hitler have his reasons. I'm not making a comparison here like Glenn Beck would, but I'm saying you can find reasons, limited, carefully selected ones, for almost any horrendous thing you want to do. But they have an editorial opinion, not the Times, Dearborn Times opinion, but the EPA's war on energy. Ooh, shame on the federal government for trying to protect our clean air, our clean water, and to get us into clean energy. Okay, if you don't have an EPA, or in Michigan, if you don't have the Department of Environmental Quality, isn't a DEQ or something that's called, which I know Snyder is going to fold together with something
DQA
else.
Or, yeah, I know what you're talking
okay.
about.
Okay. What have you got for protecting the people? Here's the situation. Two alternatives, it says, for dealing with 16 decommissioned radioactive steam generators from an Ontario nuclear power plant may put southeastern Michigan's drinking water at risk of plutonium pollution. A plan was announced earlier this month to ship the generators now at the Bruce Power Plant through the Great Lakes and the Detroit River on the way to Sweden for recycling. I guess they're giving them a great deal.
Yeah, nobody does it recycling like the Swedes.
Are they using the Queen Mary for this radioactive waste? Or
no, you know, probably the Concord.
Yeah, well, right. And while that has some environmentalist concern, probably because of potential spill, I mean, if the boat runs aground or sinks, or
sure,
there's one of those typhoons on the lakes, or a black hole or something, then it could contaminate the lake and the rest of us nearby, because plutonium is the worst. Okay? Did you know that? You know, the slightest little milligram plutonium will give people cancer instantly, and you'll die within 2 weeks. And then we're talking about thousands, mm-hmm, with just the slightest little milligram. And, of course, Fermi 1, which is shuttered and closed and is a shrine to the idiocy of nuclear power down there in Monroe, Fermi 2 is producing electricity with it. But Fermi 1 was a breeder reactor that not only used plutonium but was making more plutonium for use in other reactors, which is a bogus idea because several of those plants, including the one at Fermi 1, have now gone almost, you know, they melted down or they partially melted down and they're closed. And the one in Fermi has to be kept shut and sealed for over 100,000 years. That's how dangerous it is.
What was the name of that book?
We Almost Lost Detroit, 1966.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
And Detroit Edison says, we didn't almost lose Detroit. Well, yes, we did. The word almost, okay, is a qualifier there. Don't you know English grammar? It almost had the so-called China syndrome meltdown
right. That
would have ruptured the containment shell. And within 48 hours, because there was no wind that night in 1966, it would have killed everybody in Detroit, Ann Arbor, and Toledo. And nobody could have lived here for 100,000 years.
Right.
That would have been a really historic nuclear disaster.
I would say that would kill our tourism.
So what happened was fuel rods melted down, but a couple didn't. And the few that didn't prevented that sort of explosion, not a nuclear explosion, but an explosion that would rupture the containment shell, and all the cooling was liquid sodium, which was vaporized with the plutonium, and it would be that cloud that would have killed everybody. So it wouldn't be a nuclear blast, but it's the coolant that is infused with plutonium dust that would, and it still can. It still can. Okay, that's that dangerous still. And so we did almost lose Detroit and Toledo and Ann Arbor for 100,000 years, and now they got to keep that thing guarded and make sure there's not going to be any concrete fissures for 100,000 years. And if anybody knows anything about the way we make concrete these days, it's not going to last. We're going to have to build shell upon shell upon shell as we see the cracks form over the next 100,000 years.
Wow. Now,
most concrete will start the way we make it today, will start cracking and crumbling in about 50 years.
Right.
So how many containment shells would that to start building around the sucker?
I'm not real good at math, but a lot.
Unless they figure out something else. So activist here, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission announced February 4th that it would issue a license to ship the generators to Sweden. But before that can happen, permission must be obtained through Transport Canada, the U.S. Department of Transportation, and the United Kingdom, Norway, and Denmark.
Yeah.
Because it's got to go through all those waters, you know, from the different...
So if one country or one entity says no, does that kill the whole idea? Obviously,
It should, unless they find another route through another country. Transport Canada spokeswoman Maryse Durrett said last week that as long as regulations are being followed regarding the transportation of dangerous shipments, her agency would defer to the decision of the Canadian
Nuclear Safety Commission.
Nuclear Safety Commission.
All right.
But what about our activists here? Activists are concerned about the risk inherent with the possibility of an accident or storm damage, as I said, which could drop any of the generators. And again, there are 16 of them, which weigh about 100 tons each and are the size of a school bus, into one of the Great Lakes or even the Detroit River. Well, it's unlikely to happen, but it's a possibility. Why take the risk, said Ed McCardle of the Sierra Club for Southwestern Michigan. There's a picture of Ed in there, gray beard like myself, and he's very concerned, as would anyone be concerned, of course. He says, depending on where and when that spill actually happens, it'll get into the potential drinking water, because we get our water from the Great Lakes, from the Detroit River, or at least into the ecosystem and accumulate in fish. We already have some radioactive contamination in the Great Lakes. And in fact, he's holding up in this large photo from Sue Suchita that she took, a poster, Great Lakes Nuclear Hotspots. And there is at least... six different areas, because there's pictures there, around the Great Lakes that already have nuclear contamination, radioactive contamination. And I didn't know that, but of course Sierra Club does. And so any additional risk should not happen. Of course, what does that do for Ontario? Well, they're going to have to bury it, I guess, or find their own containment shell for 100,000 years.
The other, I know this is dumb, but I don't like the idea that this gives people that might do us harm ideas. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, this is, hey, oh, by the way, really bad stuff is on this spot at this time. You know what I mean? I don't know, whatever. It's news, so it has to be reported. But I just keep thinking in my mind about all the things that can go wrong. And right next to that is a wonderful picture of George Durrani.
Yes, George, boy, he's really got an active public relations person. He's been proposing, introducing bill after bill on a variety of topics, and he gets his picture in the paper and gets a press release on all of this.
You get his emails too, don't you?
George Durrani, for example, in the Press and Guide on page 1A last Sunday, don't leave seniors and families out in the cold. And this time, do something for seniors to punish people that might commit con games, fraud against them. And it really is you know, something that we're all concerned about. I guess George knows that there's plenty of senior citizens in this area, and so, but he's only introduced these bills, co-sponsored several, but he's doing a lot of that.
He's very active
up there, and maybe Gino Polidori was, but I never heard anything except maybe once a year in Gino's newsletters about what he supported or what he introduced. To my knowledge, he never introduced any bills of his own. Exclusively of his own. Now, that's not bad. There's a lot of bills floating around. You got to figure out which one you're for,
right,
and, you know, advocate it, support it or not. And that's a job too. I mean, but imagine, you know, the activist, the Sierra Club, which I'm a member of, let's in fair disclosure here.
Okay.
They're
friends of the show too.
Yeah, absolutely. And of the college, all the conferences we have and the meeting place we give to the Sustainability Roundtable,
that's right,
which is a Sierra Club initiated and continuing supported activity for this area. The U.S. government could play a part here. Oh, the federal government. The U.S. Department of Transportation has to give permission for this to travel through the lakes. So, see, if you want to take the federal government out of regulation and so on, then, Canada can ship all the radioactive waste it wants to.
Up until Denmark when they say no.
Yeah, up until United Kingdom, Norway, and Denmark. And right, we know the European Union, and England, for that matter, is a lot more protective of the quality of their air and water than we are here in the U.S. And, well, they should be. What else do we got? I mean, ultimately, it's water, it's air, and it's food,
right,
that's going to keep us alive, for Pete's sake. It's the most basic thing. So thank you, Sierra Club, for trying to make us aware of this and doing what you can to lobby the powers that be.
That's so cool. They really are, and they do. They make a difference.
But don't tell me we don't need an EPA. Don't tell me that. I mean, it just absolutely boggles the mind, as if it's going to hurt our energy picture. You attended some afternoon sessions at the Energy Summit here at Henry Ford Community College last Friday. One of the things I heard in the morning session, which struck me too, is that, you know, oh, we should keep nuclear power. We should go for dirty coal. We need energy. That
you heard that not at the summit.
No. That's what some people say. And the response to it that I heard is that the real answer to the energy crisis is conservation, which in many cases means regulation.
Absolutely.
In other words, don't use as much power. You say, well, how can I not use electricity in my dark room? Okay, you get a different kind of bulb. For Pete's sake, when your bulb burns out, get one of those squirrely fluorescents.
Right.
Or LEDs. We had a vendor there that was showing LED lamps.
That was pretty neat, yeah.
Last even longer. And, you know, the problem with the squirrely bulbs is they have mercury in them.
Right.
And if you don't dispose of them properly, that'll get in our ecosystem, as it's called, and hurt us. Mercury makes you dumb. Yeah, it hurts your brain cells, even in small quantities. So it's very dangerous. So the LED lamps are the future. And of course, they're a little pricey now. I'm sorry to say that I think they're starting at about $20 each for an equivalent of a 60-watt light bulb.
Oh, really?
But they last a long, long time, and they use almost no energy like the squirrely fluorescent bulbs.
So, I mean, it's like most things in the when you're going green, it may be a little higher initial purchase, but it's a long term, it's a lot cheaper.
Oh, yeah. Payback in a couple of years.
Well,
easily.
It sounds like easily. It may not even take that long.
Right. And as I said, the LEDs don't have that toxic mercury in them that will harm our environment long term. So that's the way we got to go for it. I'm just saying, folks, it doesn't take too much to reconsider your basic decisions in life, whether it's the food you buy, the place you live, the car you purchase, the home you purchase, even or the energy saving modifications, to conserve. Conservation is the big answer. We can do that now. No government interference, if you think of it like that, needed. And don't tell me we need dirty coal and more nuclear plants.
No, sometimes conservation is as simple as using common sense and turning the light off on the TV when you leave the room. What is the, Jay, you know, is it called vampire energy or whatever?
Yeah.
Okay. When things are plugged in and you're not using them, computers, lights, everything.
You can save, they estimate most people's use of even electric clocks that are plugged in your room, and you say, well, I need the clock. Well, you ever know they have wind-up clocks, and do you know your cell phone has a clock
people
on it?
People got along for a lot of time without it.
Yeah. But it's other appliances, even TVs, VCRs, that what you can do is to save on, I mean, they're always draining power to keep some of their circuits active, so they turn on faster.
Right.
I know my DVD player, if I don't have it plugged in, and I usually don't because I'm trying to save that energy, it might take 3 minutes to actually come on and be ready to play a DVD. But when it's on stop and it looks like it's off, it's still using electricity and it's ready. I just push the open tray button and it'll pop right out in 10 seconds rather than wait 3 or 4 minutes. So that's the phantom power that's going to a lot of these devices. What they recommend is to have all of them plugged into a bigger power strip.
Right.
And so when you go to bed at night or you leave the house, turn off all of them at once.
Really simple.
And yes, it'll take your TV and the other sets a minute or two to come back up to full quality, but it doesn't hurt them to be totally turned off.
Totally turned off.
Yeah.
Well, and my wife did that with the fridge, but the money we saved on electricity, we spent on new food.
Well, okay, I hope it was good, healthy, local food.
But it kept spoiling once you turned the fridge off.
Oh, fridge, oh, yeah.
Well, okay, thanks for getting that right away there,
Jim. Yeah, okay. Don't want to turn the fridge off. Okay, looking down the other stories, we already talked about, and there's actually the editorial in Times Herald for this week. Brian Winston, Dearborn Public School Superintendent, how Snyder's budget will impact our classrooms. Basically, it's just going to cut the heck out of them, okay, and all the schools, and who knows how they're going to make up that money. Dearborn Press and Guide from Wednesday, that is March the 2nd, today is March the 4th, cities look to share services, and we do know that the city of Dearborn libraries are sharing services with Dearborn Heights mm-hmm. now. I don't know if there's any cost savings right now, but maybe there will be in the future. We heard in the mayor's State of the City address, Mayor O'Reilly's State of the City address, that they may look to helping Melvindale with their police department.
Huh.
Yeah. And it was a big to-do in the papers last week, or earlier this week, is that Allen Park has given layoff notices to all of their firemen.
All of them.
All of them.
So,
but it's like the teachers
right.
each year. Everybody gets a so-called pink slip, and then you rehire those that you need, that legally, according to your contract, you can't be summarily, that is instantly fired, if there's not enough money.
Right.
You have to give people like 90-day notice.
Okay.
So they might hire back most of their firemen, or they might find some other fire department nearby to help them out.
Well, you've heard other communities going through the same things. Pontiac, for instance, and Wayne. And it wasn't just fire. It was police, I believe, also. So, no, it's tight everywhere.
Okay, so now I'm going to take up time, and I may not get Jim Hightower to comment in. We usually do that halfway through. But we have a very important editorial opinion from Jack Lessenberry.
This is good, yeah.
In this week's Detroit Metro Times. And the big headline is How to Save Detroit. And in fact, it's his suggestion, which doesn't come until the end of it, and I think you need to hear all of it if you haven't got a Metro Times to read, is that... Well, it'll involve. It takes more than a village. It takes all of us to save Detroit. It begins with a quote from Mayor Dave Bing that was in the Washington Post back in February. When I was elected, I thought I knew what was going on, but I got here and found out things were way worse than I ever imagined. Now, of course, Glenn Beck last week had a special article about the ruins of Detroit.
Yeah, but he was just slamming us.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Lessenberry has our best interest in mind. It has solutions. He comes with solutions.
The numbers are there, and right. I'll get to that in a second. Let me see if I can find that. Online, there is a sort of a conspiratorial newspaper that also publishes a print edition, and I love different opinions. It's called the American Free Press, and their website is americanfreepress.net. And again, they're always looking for conspiracies, but unlike Glenn Beck, they find them in different places. And back at the end of January, I printed this out, Detroit's demise, a dire warning for other cities. So maybe Beck saw this finally after a month and decided to put it on the air. The numbers are not good. Even, who was it? Donald Trump was being interviewed on by Letterman a couple nights ago.
Right.
And of course, Letterman said, hey, where would you go to find a job these days, you know? And he said, oh, China.
Trump said that?
Just move to China, yeah, because that's where all the jobs are.
Yeah.
And then he said...
He's going to make a great president, isn't he?
He said, in order to find a job in the U.S., you have to move to those cities that still have jobs, that you can't stay in the same area. And one example, this is how I perked up at 12:10 a.m., was one of the two cities they gave an example, and I forget the other one because I was just
It was 12:10 in the morning.
No, I was gasping anyway.
Oh, really?
Detroit.
To move here?
You can't stay here. No, oh, there's no jobs here.
Yeah.
Now, I think in specialized areas, we always need people who have special skills. I mean, the city is still running, and so is the suburbs. So there are still jobs here that need to be filled by people with specialized skills and a lot of expertise. But you know, it was one example that Letterman added, and Trump nodded. If you're living in Detroit and you're looking for a job, don't stay.
You've
got to go somewhere else.
If you read a little bit and scan the paper or the news and listen to the news, yeah, you might get that impression.
I can see how
people would.
So here's the Lessenberry article, and I'll try to go quickly because I know you can listen faster than I can talk. So listen up. Turn up your radio. Here it goes. Jack Lessenberry says, a half century ago, when the mayor was still a high school basketball star, Detroit was a happening place. Downtown Hudson's was the tallest department store in the world. They were, alas, knocking down Old City Hall thanks to the new modernistic city-county building. Historic preservation wasn't much on anyone's mind because Motown still saw itself as a young and vibrant city. Sure, it had lost a little population, something experts at the time put down to the freeways, but Detroit still had nearly 1.7 million people. 71% of them were white, but the black population was not only mushrooming, it was making itself heard. Please, Mr. Postman, would be Motown's first number one nationwide hit that year. The Red Wings made the Stanley Cup Finals. Wow. The Detroit Tigers would stun everyone by winning 101 games, only to be beaten out at the end by the Yankees. That was 68, right?
Change. No, they won in 68.
Right. Oh, they won in 68.
Yeah.
So this was a little before that time. Okay. Change was coming, though. That fall, for the first time, a young politician running for mayor would openly court the black vote, maybe 66, I think. With their help, Jerry Kavanaugh would pull off the biggest upset victory in Detroit mayoral history. When he took office, he was only 33 years old. It was an age of young men. The governor, John Swainson, was only 35. When he took office. The new mayor believed in Detroit, believed in the future, believed in cities. Today, Detroit City is a very different place than those vibrant leaders must have dreamed it would be. Soon we'll have the final census figures from last year. The city almost certainly has fewer than 800,000 people, the vast majority of them black. They are overwhelmingly poor, poorly skilled, and poorly educated. The affluent have largely left. The skilled have left. Many who want decent public schools for their kids have left. And the city left behind is being crushed by debt. According to the Washington Post, which did a long story on Detroit last month, the city's long-term debt is $5.7 billion. Now, remember, the state for the end of this year will be, I think, $1.8 billion in debt. But the city's long-term debt is $5.7 billion. That's almost more than the state of Wisconsin, which is $8 billion, by the way.
Right.
Actually, Michigan is doing pretty well as a state. We only have $1.8 billion debt.
Well, there was
even
Schneider's,
Wisconsin has got $8 billion
worth of debt. It seems like anytime anybody asks Schneider anything, he says, well, you know, we're not Wisconsin.
Yeah, thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
So something we've done over the last several years has helped to stay the disaster that is several other states. Even Texas, after the governor had covered up for 3 years the state they were in,
amazing.
They've got about a $15 billion debt, and they don't know how to cover that. And it's always looked, oh, they pay their teachers almost nothing. And it's true, they do. They're some of the lowest paid teachers in the country. Well, how did Texas get into a $15 billion debt? They got the highest debt amount with a conservative Republican governor for years, and George Bush before that, of course, next to California.
Right.
You know, which is like $60 billion debt or something. It's unbelievable. So Detroit has $5.7 billion long-term debt. And it says the city has no chance to pay it off. The annual budget deficit has been wrestled down to $150 million before the city got the bad news about the governor's budget. Among other things, it once again slashed revenue sharing for the umpteenth time. That's money the city needed to keep going. In fact, I read somewhere else the city needs federal and state to give them $25 million to demolish all the areas that are unoccupied and, you know, blight areas.
Right.
To make them green areas maybe someday, or to raise food on them, or to rebuild. Well, nobody's going to pay them $25 million to demolish the disastrous areas that are Well, they're just derelict areas.
No, and one Heidelberg project's enough, right?
Dave Bing, Lessenberry goes on, is more than twice the age of the mayor Detroit had a half century ago and seemed older and wearier than his 67 years. The governor's budget, he says, quote, has potentially devastating consequences for a city of Detroit. It threatens the concrete but fragile gains we have made. We simply can't afford it, he said. Later, when discussing labor negotiations, the mayor said, I know change is difficult, I know change takes time, but we are getting there. Lessenberry then comes back and says, but is Detroit really getting there? Can it get there? Bing specifically meant the negotiations. During his State of the City speech, he talked about building something they would have taken for granted a half century ago, a city that works. Lessenberry says Detroit doesn't work now. Dave Bing knows that and admitted as much, something other mayors wouldn't have dreamt of doing. Well, so Bing's got his hopes up here. I'm going to jump on down to the answer.
Yeah, that's
okay, because I know you're waiting for that.
I kind of am.
He thinks most of the people in Detroit are divorced from reality, in denial.
Mm-hmm.
And he reminded people in a speech, and I didn't hear Bing's State of the City address, but he said that Detroit is a city where 50,000 false security alarms get pulled every year. No wonder the cops don't know where to go to help people. 50,000 alarms. And as the mayor put it also, he said, we must also continue educating our residents about the appropriate use of 911.
911?
911, yeah. As in, Lessenberry says, don't call it if your cat is sick. So things are only getting worse for Detroit. They're not good. And what happened in Lansing, of course, and even Delaney was concerned about this, what did pass this week, emergency fund managers, it's easier to appoint one by the state to run troubled cities, school districts, or other governments. Okay, so that was the day after the State of the City address, the Michigan House of Representatives passed the bill. I don't think it's been put into action yet. But in this bill, when you appoint this emergency fund manager, EMF person at the state level, you don't need any support from the city or the state, no request to come in and help. They can just decide to do it anytime. They have the ability to void all labor contracts, strip all local officials of all their powers. Nor would emergency fund managers have to be an individual. The law could permit the state treasurer to appoint a firm to govern the city. Lessenberry says, does that mean, say, that nationwide security contractors could be given total power in Detroit if it came to that? And he swears here, and he says, definitely it could. Needless to say, this, in other words, some corporation could be hired to run a city and instantly take away all the rights and powers of any elected officials. And this is if the state wants to do it. And, of course, that's what the governor of Wisconsin is trying to set up, too. But it would be actually easier than what the governor of Wisconsin is doing to destroy public sector unions. Because once you got an EFM appointed by the state, by their edict, they can do anything they want to with the city.
Does that sounds vindictive in a sense, doesn't it?
It sounds like they can create an instant dictatorship at the state level. Where's Glenn Beck when we need him on this one?
Yeah.
You know, this is a major intrusion of civil rights. Now, of course, if a city goes bankrupt, can't pay its bills, then somebody's got to help them.
They go into receivership, right?
So yeah, then
they
have but to manager. Take away all the powers of everybody there, maybe forever. It doesn't say how long the EFM has to be there. This just gives the state total power to go in, and this is not the federal government, folks. This is your friendly state government, to go in and take over the operation of everything and operate it however it wants to, or even a corporation to come in. Wouldn't that be a disaster? And Lessenberry has got this the word directly from Joe Harris, who was the City of Detroit Auditor General from 1995 to 2005. Right now, Harris has a cushy job. I'm sorry, it's not cushy. He's the EMF in Benton Harbor.
Okay.
So he's the total dictator in Benton Harbor right now.
Right.
And he has more power than ever over what happens in that city.
Who does EMF report to? The state.
Legislature.
Okay.
And the treasurer.
Sure.
The governor, whatever. I mean, just
so that's what I'm saying.
Nobody locally.
But no, but so in a sense, this is an extension of the state government. So, I mean, you can't fault the EMF or the company that plays that role, right?
Well, if you believe in democracy, what's being eliminated here is any sort of input from the local community.
Which makes no sense because it affects them most.
Right.
Right.
Yep. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, Lessenberry says that's a tragedy, and that could be a disaster, of course, and he's not in favor of that kind of power. However, what is the answer for Detroit that even I know when I started school back 40 years ago that was taught in political science class and urban planning classes I took. What is the answer for these large metro areas to get their act together to save money? Well, of course, as we know, it's combining services among communities for cost savings.
Sure.
But in Detroit area, especially since Detroit is so big and such a disastrous economic situation here, and social situation too, the answer is to combine, yes, by EMF fiat from the state, Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb County, and make it all Detroit. Hey, folks out there, what do you think of that one?
Where'd everybody go?
Yeah.
Crickets.
But that is the answer. Think about it. If all the rich and educated and the tax base is in the so-called suburbs, and in fact, even the suburbs wanted to control that Detroit water
power. You're right.
Okay. Let's make us all Detroit. Right. And as I'm just thinking of Austin, I was looking at the map today for Austin since I'll be visiting next week and Dennis will be sitting in as host. Boy, that's going to be a wild show. Oh,
and the cat's away.
Yeah. Whoa. Watch out for that one.
Yeah.
But 50 miles in every direction.
Yeah.
Is Austin.
All right.
And they keep expanding the borders further as the suburbs and services are needed because it's kind of like desert and when they get out real far. And so they got the room to expand, but they keep expanding the city.
Why? Because it's effective. That's
because
why.
It's effective. It keeps all the tax base together. It's key. Economies of scale for police and fire and water and sewage.
Hey.
And Metro Transit is one of the best in the country there. $1.25 ticket per day to go anywhere you want to all day and all night.
And Dearborn sure could use some of those schools they're trying to close. Just over the border in Detroit. Seriously, they're packed.
Yeah, I know. It'd be a major reorganization.
Wow.
People say, oh, the change. We'll be part of Detroit. That'll bring us down.
No. Bring Detroit up.
It'll help all these mayors, whether it's Allen Park or Melvindale or City of Dearborn Heights, to really organize what will work for the whole area. We're talking about Metro Transit, and it'll take maybe 10 or 20 years to work out the details, but by golly, and this is not a new idea, folks.
No.
All the people that are well-educated about urban planning know that the metro areas that are working in this country are the large metro areas that have incorporated all of the suburbs as part of their own city for the cost savings, whether it's pension or health care or running the schools. So
Detroit did the opposite, if you think about it. Right. It closed its borders.
That's why there's only 800,000 people left, and they don't have the money to do anything for
them. And they're not working there. I mean, let's face it, there are a lot of jobs out in the suburbs. You're right.
Yep.
You're right.
So it's a great idea. Here's another great idea, and I hate to say I told you so. There should have a segment on this show that Koronik said, I told you
so. It starts next week. Too bad you can't be here.
it's starting tonight.
Okay.
Today, actually. And what it's all about is...
Uh-oh.
Is an editorial in the New York Times. When Jim Schoolmaster was here, I posited to him off the top of my head. I said, look, you got all these pension costs, and they're out of control. And everybody's got pensions here, pensions there, pensions everywhere. Why doesn't the federal government just have one pension for everybody? It will lower costs, and it will guarantee, well, by golly, here it is, New York Times, to the best economists in the United States, a very brief editorial statement. Henry TCU, professor at the University of Texas School of Law, and Terrence Odian is a finance professor at the University of California, Berkeley. Well, everybody knows that Berkeley and U of Texas, where is U of Texas? Austin. Yeah. Okay.
You're so smug.
How to pay for old age. Well, just listen here. And this is what Koronik said, okay, to Schoolmaster, off the top of my head, okay? Life expectancy at birth for Americans is about age 78, but many Americans will die well before then, while others, like Eunice Sanborn, who died in Texas last month, will live to be 114. Wow, good for her.
Yes.
Anyone planning for retirement must answer an impossible question. How long will I live? If you overestimate your longevity, you might scrimp unnecessarily. If you underestimate, you might outlive your savings. Hardly a new problem, yet not a single financial product offers a satisfactory solution to the risk. We believe... Here's what they say, that a new product, a federally issued inflation-adjusted annuity, would make it possible for people to deal with this problem with the bonus of contributing to the public coffers. In other words, it'll make money for the government, their plan. By doing good for individuals, the federal government could actually do well for itself. What a concept.
What a That's the synergy we're all after.
Well, you're right. It also goes for the health care plan I was talking about. But it says the insurance industry sells an inflation-adjusted annuity that goes part of the way towards helping people cope with the possibility of outliving their savings. If you bought that, I mean, if you did that. During your working years or at the time of retirement, you can pay a premium to an insurance company in exchange for the promise that the company will pay you a fixed annuity annual income adjusted for inflation until you die. But in a world in which AIG had an excellent rating only days before it became a ward of the state, how can someone, particularly a young person, know for sure which insurance companies will be solvent half a century from now? Annuities aren't federally guaranteed. The only backstops are state-based systems, and the current protection ceilings are sometimes modest. If an insurance company goes under, the retiree may end up with nothing close to what was promised. One of the reasons all the pension funds are in trouble is because of the downturn in the investments, in their investments, in this or that or whatever, in 2008.
Right.
Okay. The federal government can offer a product that solves the problem, they say. Individuals would face no more risk of default than that associated with treasury bills and other obligations backed by the United States. Of course, if the United States goes broke, then we're in trouble. Let's hope China doesn't ask for all their money at once. Anyway,
and small bills.
They say here's how it would work. Initially, people who wanted to buy this insurance would enroll through one of the qualified retirement savings plans already offered to the public, like a 401k. Plan and could choose the annuity option instead of or in addition to investment in stocks, bonds, or funds. How much the payouts would be based on a variety of factors, including interest rates on government bonds, mortality tables, and other things. Now, this new product wouldn't cost the government a penny. In fact, the Treasury would benefit. It is only an incremental move beyond issuing inflation-adjusted bonds, which the Treasury already does. By allowing the government to tap a new class of investors, the cost of government borrowing overall would probably drop. Moreover, by expanding the government's base of domestic investors, the plan would help address over-reliance on foreign lenders.
That's like huge.
China. Who now own close to half of all the outstanding federal debt. So just like we're trapped with foreign oil,
right,
we're also trapped with foreign holders of our debt.
Right.
Okay. And by the way, that federal debt is 10 times the proportion it was in 1970. Now, it says, true, the government would be on the hook if a technological breakthrough caused an unanticipated increase in life expectancy. So if they found a way to expand our lives by 20 or 30 years.
Which then, they will.
Yeah. But even Social Security will take a hit on that one.
Because, you know, the insurance companies, that's in their best interest to make us live longer, too. So
right. Well, this whole plan would spur growth in private annuities, but it's a federal program, but it would spur growth in private annuities, and the risk, such risk-free government annuities would be, the monthly payments would be, since the inflation-adjusted monthly payments on such risk-free government annuities would be low, many retirees may choose to supplement them with riskier, higher-paying annuities. So you can still do whatever you want.
Right. It's like getting term insurance and then investing the rest.
But it's the way the federal government, and of course, if you just heard me talk about this, you may say, well, I don't want to trust the federal government. But it's different than Social Security.
Right.
But it is a way that the government could actually make money on this plan. I think Republicans and Democrats, if they understood it, could like it.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Dennis has a late-breaking story.
I just thought it was really interesting because we had talked about it in the beginning, probably last summer, wasn't it? When Andiamo and they had a group of employees that basically had said, hey, there's a discrimination going on here. And it went on and on and on. And we find out finally, this is dated from the Press and Guide, Tuesday, March 1st.
Mm-hmm.
J. Patrick Pepper said, Andiamo reaches settlement in labor lawsuit. Now, the two sides reached a confidential agreement in January, according to federal court records. And the two sides being a group of employees with legal representation, and I believe most of them were former employees with legal representation, mm-hmm. and against Andiamo. And the thing that I like best is that the joint statement with Andiamo said that both parties set aside good faith differences to reach the resolution. And although the specifics of that resolution won't be made public, it is said that it includes innovative anti-discrimination measures, complaint resolution procedures, and changes to training, hiring, break, and uniform policies. And let's face it, that really is the training part. I'm glad. At first, I have to tell you, and this is not my opinion or whatever, but on the face
it's
of
not.
It, well, it's
a fact.
It's well, I drew a conclusion. So in a sense, it was my opinion. But based on the information back in the beginning, I'm like thinking, oh, this is just a ruse. This is an employee or a group of employees that felt that weren't treated fairly, and they're going back. Well, apparently, for them to reach a settlement, there were things that needed to be done on both sides. So it's nice when you come up with some kind of an equitable resolution. I like it.
Yeah, we do want to thank Andiamo, not only for equitable resolutions, but for the great jazz benefit for us. The jazz event last Saturday night went very well. Thank you for all those who attended and listened to 4 hours of fantastic local jazz artists entertaining us in a very classy venue with a very inexpensive pasta bar that people could get on the side. And apparently, Andiamo sold a lot of pasta wristbands, pasta buffet wristbands, and they made a profit too. But we're going to be needing to do a lot more fundraising, about 10 times more benefits or ask for the support of our gentle listeners big time in this April. Times are tough for all of us, but a small contribution from each and every one of you would be all we'd need to keep going another year here on not just the journal, but also the whole station. We're not in any immediate threat, but unlike public broadcasting, that's funded by the federal government, but we need the constant level of support that we've had in the past.
And that's the best time to ask for that is when we're in a position right now where we can continue giving people the programming that they enjoy. Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, Tuesday will be the next installment of Campus Connection, a show Lindsay and I have been hosting now for over a year, and I like it.
Right. We have about 1 minute to 2 o'clock. It's WHFR Dearborn listening to. We're waiting the arrival of Joanne Korchinski, and Highway 61 will start shortly. Our podcast usually cuts off 2 minutes after. I feel I can keep talking for a little while because we started 3 minutes late. And I hope you know how to use the podcast tools, folks. If you're downloading this, you know, there's always at least a minute, if not a couple minutes like today, before we start. So you just can fast forward that. There's a little slider there, a little cursor. Just click on it and pull, and you can get right to the beginning of the show. A couple things coming up here on the journal, and you never know exactly what's going to happen, so you got to tune in even, you know, next Friday on the 11th. Well, we're always working behind the scenes to make sure something happens.
That's true.
On the 18th, we have an interview with Diane Green about non-traditional seminars, jobs for men that they might not normally consider. That's going to happen on the 23rd on campus. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll be mentioning more about that in your show, Campus Connection, this Tuesday.
And we'll also talk to Diane Green at some point, I believe on the 18th.
She's coming on the 18th,
that's right.
As I said.
Excellent.
I just said that, yes. And on the 25th of this month of March, George Duraney will be here right after he gets done at the Senior Center, ending at 1 o'clock. He's going to scoot on over, and we're going to ask him the details of his first 3 months.
I'm looking forward
to legislature that. And how much he pays his press release person to get those statements out every week.
She's very nice. I had an opportunity to talk to her. Really nice.
Great.
Nice woman.
Also looking ahead to April, Jerry Jablinski, the theater program, talks about the new play to be offered here on campus for your entertainment. And he'll be here on April 1st, no fooling. And the 8th, 1 week before the big tax day, we're going to have Don Dabrowski, who is the, he's like the PR head, if not the president, who is in charge of Michigan Fair Tax Proposal.
Yes, he's the media coordinator and knows this. He's so knowledgeable.
Yeah, I get his email every week about what they're doing.
He's a newsletter editor, too, isn't he?
Yep. Right, yeah. So we'll ask Duraney about Michigan Fair Tax. I just got done sending an email to Morris Hood, Michigan Senator Hood, about this, because it's one of those answers, not a Democrat or Republican thing, therefore nobody likes it, I guess, but it's a real tax answer for everybody, individuals and businesses. And we'll talk more about that if you haven't heard about it here on the show before.